I'm Ken Best, editor of UConn Magazine. Gina Barreca is professor of English literature and feminist theory in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences and a nationally known author and humorist. She writes a blog for the Chronicle of Higher Education and a weekly column with Larry Cohen for the Hartford Courant. In 2008, she wrote in UConn Magazine about how she became interested in humor as a scholarly subject and why humor is important. The paperback edition of her latest book, It's Not That I'm Bitter, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquer the World, has just been published by St. Martin's Press. Our conversation began with Professor Barreca sharing her delight in how the subtitle of her book sounds when it is introduced by a man.
I love, actually, when male announcers have to read the subtitle with the panty lines line. That is actually one of my favorite things. I didn't realize when I was subtitling the book, How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquer the World, that the men who were going to have to interview me would have to say that line. And it's just one of those things that just continues to delight me, one of those little tiny found pieces of humor that get us through the day.
Well, in reading the book, you write for both sexes. You know, you're not just writing for women, although you are a specialist in the study of women and humor. I think you'll learn a lot from your writings by reading it. And humor, of course, can be used in many different ways, but it's clear that you're using it as a learning tool as well.
I like to think so. My academic work, you know, I've been at UConn for 23 years now, which is sort of astonishing. This last year, I met the child of someone I had had as an undergraduate who is now coming to UConn. And that made me feel old in a way that I don't usually feel, like, wow, I've really been here since the Earth's crust cooled. But that's great. I mean, I have a sense of legacy. I have a sense of institutional memory. UConn has been a real home for me. But since I started here, the first book that I did was a scholarly collection on women's humor called Last Laughs. And then I did a follow-up volume originally titled The Daughter of Last Laughs, which, of course, would have come out to Dahl, but then the publishers decided that they would call it New Perspectives on Women in Comedy. But that's what I really started with. It was looking at anger and humor in 20th century British women's literature. And after that, I started applying the theories that I had about women, gender difference in humor, to what is laughingly called real life. And not only looking at Jane Austen and Virginia Woolf and Muriel Spark and Faye Weldon, but looking at the women around me and the aunts who raised me in Brooklyn, New York, the little Italian women who were 750 pounds and 3 feet two and looked like Ottomans, or the women that I went to Dartmouth with as one of the first classes of women admitted to that institution. And it was an institution, the Dartmouth School for Boys, as we used to refer to it. And then, you know, starting graduate school when there were still fewer women going into the profession than there are now. And so the kinds of humor that we discovered in life made a wonderful counterpart to what I was looking at and finding in women's literature. So those two have been my focus for the past 23 years. And you can't talk about women's humor without, by default, talking about men's humor. So I've been having a good time.
There's virtually no subject you don't cover in this book. Now, is this a collection of material that has been sort of percolating over the years, or did you just sit down and rethink a lot of things? Because it's like 40 little stand-up routines almost, the chapters in this book.
Well, I take that as enormous flattery, actually. People always ask me if I do stand-up comedy, and I said, well, I have a two-book minimum, not a two-drink minimum. I'm a very serious teacher, as my students will tell you. I teach at 8 in the morning and at 9:30, and I shut the door, and nobody comes in late, and nobody misses class, and we discuss very serious matters. And then, you know, once they're a month into it, and I know they're, you know, then we can lighten up. But this book, It's Not That I'm Bitter, some of them evolved from essays that I'd written for the Hartford Courant, where I do a column with Larry Cohen, or they came from, as you mentioned, I blog for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where they came from writing for a number of other places, including Psychology Today, where I also blog regularly. But a lot of them just came from sort of hitting 50, which is when I started writing the book, and realizing that there were a lot of ways in which women still buy this bill of goods that the world gives us. We still believe that if we go around with firm thighs and a flat tummy and, you know, taut arms, we'll be happy, when all it really takes to make us happy is a plate of cheese snacks. You know, I mean, it's really not so complicated to find good stuff in everyday life. And that's what It's Not That I'm Bitter is really about, because it turns out that you don't have to be bitter. What you have to do is to be able to laugh, not only at yourselves, but at the world, which is so absurd.
There is a documentary about Joan Rivers that is just out, and I think you're probably familiar with it. She's been doing a lot of interviews. And her basic position, given all that she's been through in her life, and as a pioneer, as a woman in comedy, is that you have to go on, and if you can't laugh about it, what's the point?
Well, I mean, there are two ways of going through life. You either laugh or you cry and throw up. And laughing is just so much more acceptable at any dinner party, and you look a lot better. So I'm going with the whole laughing as the response to life. But it's also since women have been either sort of put underfoot or put on pedestals, both of them are entirely unrealistic positions in terms of actually being able to grasp humanity. And laughing is one of the things that makes us human. And it's when women really get together and really laugh, we really laugh. And one of my big sort of evangelical parts of my life is to make sure that women learn to share our laughter with the men that we respect and we love and we care about and we work with, so that we're not just keeping the laughter for the ladies' room or the kitchen or those all female places. And because what we tend to do when we're around men is to do what I call the silver bell tinkling laughter, where we go something like, no woman has ever made that noise when she's actually having a good time. When women really laugh, we don't go, we go, and that's a slightly less feminine sound. We need to get that noise out there a little bit more.
Well, you address this specifically in one chapter of the book where you say women are funnier than men. That's why when you hear laughter coming out of the ladies' room, it's because we're having a good time in there.
Right. And there is almost never laughter coming out of the men's room. And actually, that was one thing I learned as a student at Dartmouth College, was if there is laughter coming out of the men's room, actually, we should worry. I mean, you guys don't have separate stalls. It's not like a sharing place. We're women in the ladies' room. What we're doing, we're not telling jokes. We're just telling the truth about our lives. That's all it takes. All a woman has to do, when a woman says, I have something funny to tell you, if you're smart, you'll sit down, because you're going to be there for a long, long time. She is not going to tell you two blondes walk into a bar with a Dalmatian. She's going to say, okay, I was driving on 84 and they said to get off at exit 68, but I know it's 67. You know, I wanted to stop and get a cup of coffee, and I know that there's this little place, and I'm trying not to go to Starbucks because I don't want to really, you know, get too much caffeine. And other women are coming over going, well, you know what you do is you get half calf, half decaf, and then you put in half milk and half, half, and half, and other women are gathering. And men have no idea what you're talking about, because they're waiting to hear something funny. And women at this point are now talking about, you know, whether they're taking estrogen orally or through a patch. And a man is still waiting for a punchline, and there is no punchline. The funny part is simply the story of our lives.
Because you do make the point, men tell jokes, women tell stories.
Right. Men are, when they say, I have something funny to tell you, they'll tell you a joke, they'll show you a top 10 list, or they'll show you part of their anatomy that they photocopied at the last Christmas party. But women over 50, we know not to do that, because we get yearly mammograms. And if part of us is going to go on a Xerox machine, Blue Cross is paying for half. So we just don't do that kind of stuff. Of course, also at UConn, no one would ever do that. But it's the idea that men and women are brought up to have different kinds of senses of humor. Men use humor from when you're kids as ways to harass and bond simultaneously. Guys will go up to other guys and go, yo, bucket face. Women don't do this. Women do not insult other women ritually by way of saying, hi, how you doing? How are the kids? This is now what we do. Women do not go up to other women and say, Gloria, 3 months pregnant and going heavy on the gravy. We don't do that. We have other rituals. But men will insult each other. I mean, and this starts when you're 4 years old. You see little boys making fun of each other's trucks. Little girls are making nice towards each other's Barbies.
Well, let's continue on this subject of men and women. One of the funnier sections of the book that struck me immediately was the section, what happened when Prince Charming becomes older? Why does he not become King Charming?
There is no King Charming. It is in It's Not That I'm Bitter. I really spent a lot of time thinking about the book the chapter titles within the book, so that one of them is, why is there no King Charming? Because you've got Prince Charming, and Prince Charming clearly is a polygamist. He marries everybody. He marries Cinderella. He marries Snow White. He marries Sleeping Beauty. He's all over the place. He's like one of those guys who just skip town when he's done. He probably has a lot of different social security numbers. I do not trust Prince Charming. But you notice that he never becomes king. You know, he sort of stays in that position, like Prince Charles. And I was thinking now, as I discuss in the chapter, is it because once you're king, you no longer have to be charming? You know, once you're king, you could be as uncharming as you ever want because you're king. It's like Mel Brooks going, it's good to be king. You don't have to do anything when you're king. Charm out the window. You could be as mean as you want. You no more having to charm anybody. Or is it because, you know, once you're charming, then it doesn't, you don't even get to become the rank of king because you're spending all your time being charming instead of being powerful. You know, is it sort of one thing or the other? Some of the other chapters I had a good time with. There's one on sort of psychic paranormal stuff because I know a lot of women who trust their psychics much more, for example, than they trust their accountants. And so that one is called, if you don't pay your psychic, do you get, you know, if you don't pay your exorcist, do you get repossessed? There's one chapter called, why do they call it a glass ceiling when it's really just a thick layer of men? You know, I felt it was important to sort of share the lessons that I've learned after having been in the workforce for 23 years with, you know, the young women that I meet at conferences or the ones who have been in my classes. And so while I hope the lessons, and it's not that I'm bitter, are funny, I think that you'll find when you read it that, or as you did read it, that a lot of them have some kind of undercurrent that really reflects reality as it is.
Well, one of the things that you did write about when we had asked you to write about how you got started on this track of being a humorist and taking humor seriously was that humor allows you to elevate and explore your feelings, but it also allows you to cover all subjects, and you don't have to dismiss anything because everything is open to humor.
Right, and that it's not as if you only have to deal with either somehow light subjects or, you know, only popular culture or only literature. I like the idea of being all over the place. I like the messiness of humor. There's something that's both incredibly, what would I say, relaxed about humor and yet structured about humor. Humor is about timing. It's about, more than anything else, it's about paying attention. It's about having a good memory. It's about looking at the world as it is and thinking, okay, but what happens if I just nudge it this little bit further? What happens then? You know, so it's about just exaggerating what's there. It's not about making stuff up entirely out of whole cloth. I mean, one of my favorite things is the section that's in, it's not that I'm bitter, it's sort of toward the beginning, and it's about bathing suit season at TJ Maxx. And that's actually a story that I tell when I give talks, and it's actually on YouTube. One of my students put up a section from a talk that I had given at the National Speakers Association. And so bathing suit season, and that was sort of the inspiration for this particular book, for the new book, It's Not That I'm Bitter, where it was about going to look for bathing suits in April. This was a few Aprils ago. And realizing that in trying on the bathing suits with other women about my age, and at 53, my age is anybody too old for work study and too young for cremation. And and the only sounds coming from behind the sort of cheap curtains at TJ Maxx were those sounds last heard at the Spanish Inquisition. So you had women going, oh. And I thought, you know, men don't do this to themselves. Men are not trying on bathing suits. No straight man has ever tried on a bathing suit. They wear the bathing suits. Their mothers bought them when they were 17 until there's a hole in the pocket and the keys fall out, you know. And then they go to Job Lot and they go to a bin of bathing suits for $250 on sale. They pick up something. They say, it's blue. It'll fit. They take it home. Women are trying things on, you know. And so the book talks about that. But the book also talks about, for example, 50 things I learned by 51. And that was about looking at, you know, sort of revising maxims in the world. So that, for example, one of the things that we keep hearing is grow where you're planted. And I don't think that that's true unless you're an endive. You know, I think that you really need to shake the dirt off and move around a little bit. That's what education is for. I also don't believe that, you know, everything we needed to learn, we learned in kindergarten. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a university professor.
But that book was already written.
Well, exactly. But I really think that they were wrong. The guy who wrote Everything We Needed to Learn, we learned in kindergarten. That explains why Wall Street fell. Somebody should have taught them math. I also really believe, and this is one of my favorite parts of It's Not That I'm Bitter, that even Anita Loos knew better, that when she wrote Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, that that's not true. It's that actually your best friends are diamonds. It's your best friends that are everlasting, that are made under pressure, and that are of extraordinary value. And just like there's no such thing as fake diamonds, either they're real or they're not, there's no such thing as fake friends. That the imitations are tacky and they fall off if you ever get into hot water. And so I love that part. And that's the part that women come up to me and give me hugs after when I sign the book, and they have me sign it to their diamonds, to their best friends. And I enjoy moving between the really, you know, the TJ Maxx part and your best friends are diamonds part. That's the fun part for me.
Okay, Professor Gina Borecka, the book is It's Not That I'm Bitter, just out in paperback on St. Martin's Press. Thanks very much for spending time with us.
My pleasure.